This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. On the podcast for this episode, Tom Chatfield, the tech philosopher whose new book looks at how humans have lived side by side with technology for millennia and offers his ideas for how humanity will fare in the imminent AI-powered future. Tom's work often focuses on the cross-section of society and tech. He is a creator of textbooks and courses training in critical thinking, and his previous non-fiction books include How to Thrive in the Digital Age. Not only that, but he's also a novelist, having published This Is Gomorra, a thriller, back in 2019. Joining Tom in conversation today is Stephanie Hare. She's a researcher, broadcaster, and author focusing on issues such as technology, politics, and history. She's the author of her own book, Technology is Not Neutral, a short guide to technology ethics. Let's join Stephanie now with more.
I'm here with Tom Chatfield. His new book, Wise Animals, How Technology Has Made Us What We Are, is an exploration of the co-evolution of humanity and technology. Recent developments in AI have given rise to a wave of panic about everything from job losses to data bias, and from fake news to the singularity. But Tom pushes against this view of technology as a threat, instead proposing a more measured, long view. He argues that we are neither masters nor victims of our technologies, but that they are part of who we are, and our future, and theirs, is in our hands. Wise Animals is a novel combination of ethical, cultural, and evolutionary understandings of technology, as Tom challenges us to reevaluate every aspect of humanity's entwining with technology, its impact upon our lives, and what lies ahead for our exponential age. Welcome to Intelligence Squared, Tom.
Thank you very much indeed. Great to be here.
I really enjoyed reading your book and learned a lot. And wanted to first just start out with the question that every author loves, which is, you know, why? Why did you write this book? What made you decide that the world needs it?
So, I mean, I've written, I think this is my 12th book by some measures, so I can't stop writing them. But I started out with, you know, studying literature and philosophy, but being a geek who did maths and loved video games. But my first book was about video games. And I've just been obsessed, really, with the fact that through, you know, technology in all its forms, through, you know, the internet, through digital technologies, through the rise of artificial intelligence, all of the kind of ancient, remarkable stuff and achievements of our species, you know, our culture, our language, our beliefs, our loves and our longings and hopes, our governance, all of that is being mediated through radically new technologies. And I have a deep frustration, which is that I think a lot of the way that technology is debated publicly is very thin, is very much about individual users using gadgets with features. And I think we need a much richer and more humane way of talking about technology. Mm. I think we need to talk about the emotional and ethical aspects of human beings using technologies. You know, as a parent, I write a lot about my kids, who are now 8 and 10, but were much younger when I started the book. You know, we have these intense emotional relationships with technology. They mediate our relationships with each other, with society and the world. And so I want to try and bring the whole kind of gamut of philosophy and literature and anthropology and ethics, as well as technological and engineering thinking, to bear upon what it means to use and to think about technology well.
Mm. So we should probably take a step back and say then, how do you define technology? And how do you think the relationship between technology and humanity is best understood?
So I take a very broad view of technology, which is that it's the entirety of the human-made artifacts that extend and amplify our grasp of the world. This is a wildly large vision of technology that encompasses the tools that people use to make fires and flames and chairs and desks and houses and indeed written words, as well as iPhones and compasses and clocks. And the reason for doing this is exactly to have that long perspective and to understand that every technology, whether it is something new we're astonished by or something old that's slipped beneath the notice of our attention, every technology is linked to every other technology in a kind of evolutionary web, because you can only create a new technology out of pre-existing components and ideas. If you imagine the making of a computer and the millennia of ingenuity and discovery, this accumulative process that has led such a thing to become possible. So the founding idea of the book for me in some ways is that we need to look at how our species has co-evolved with technology from stones and flames through written words to computation in order to have a richer discussion about what these technologies mean. When we only focus on gadgets and new stuff, we have a debate that is very shallow about, is this new thing bad or good? Is it going to change the world? Is it going to save us? Is it going to condemn us? Is it just inevitable? We don't have a rich discussion about, well, what is the, you know, what is the story of our relationship through mediated culture, through writing, through symbols, through computation? What's the story of our relationship with the built environment, with the homes we live in, and so on and so on? So this evolutionary process for me, and understanding technology is this kind of this totality, this ecosystem almost, is just much more interesting. And I think paradoxically, actually much more realistic and practical, because it takes us towards, you know, kind of real lived dilemmas and experiences. You know, how do you help your kids use technology well? When you're really worried about deep fakes and democracy, where do you look? It takes us, I think, towards, you know, a really usefully specific engagement with these things, rather than hand-waving about superintelligent AI and apocalypses and flying to Mars, which is all really just a load of distracting noise.
I guess that brings me very naturally to the next question, which is, you know, who's your ideal reader for this book? You used the word we a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, not everybody has the same power over technology. So are you hoping product managers are going to read this, or designers, or investors, or Elon Musk, or lawmakers?
Wow. Yeah, that would all be good.
Your parents, teachers, like who is this for, and how should they be using your book?
So, I mean, my background, I guess, is kind of literary and philosophical as well. You know, when you write a book, you do a strange thing, because you talk about we, you're very grand, you know, you try to sort of talk about big things passionately, or I do. But at the same time, you're writing a book, you know, in English at a particular moment in time. So, you know, a number of people are going to read you, not a vast number of people, and you're making a very modest contribution to the world. I mean, the honest answer is, this book is for anyone who's interested. I've tried to tell a story. I've tried to write with a little kind of beauty and passion. And I've tried not to pretend I've got all the answers, to offer people questions I think are interesting. Anyone who cares about our relationships with and through technology, a product manager, yes. Elon Musk, yes, if he's got the time. Or someone who's just a parent or a writer or a thinker or a citizen who's curious about this world we live in. I've tried to say, look, a lot of the ways that technology is commonly talked about as a series of gadgets, as something distinct from us that we pick up and put down, as something that might wipe out our species or save us, a lot of these ways are, in my opinion, insufficiently rich, insufficiently alive to life as we live it. So let me try and show you some new and different ways of thinking about these things. And I guess I say at the end of the book, you know, I just want to make suggestions, to share my passionate enthusiasms with people, to say, look, isn't this interesting? Have you thought about this? In a funny way, it's almost a childish impulse. You know, it's just like, hey, here's some things that I really think are just a little beautiful or interesting or strange. Spend a bit of time thinking about them, and you might come away with a few new ways of thinking yourself.
And can you think of any examples of how the past can help us better understand the present or indeed the technology direction that we might be trying to take? I mean, you've mentioned going to Mars, for instance, or the existential risk of AI that was so famously publicized in the past year by lots of technologists. And then a bunch of people said, no, we don't think that existential risk is the biggest risk for AI. How does having this longer view that you explain so well in your book help with that debate?
So, I mean, and it's fair enough, of course, for us to worry about existential risks. I don't want to say we shouldn't worry about worst case scenarios for our species. I just mean we should think about them alongside a whole bunch of other stuff, that that shouldn't be the only thing we think about. It can't be a full stop. I mean, in the book, I talk quite a bit about the philosopher Plato and his, you know, fairly well known today, I think, writings around the invention of writing. He lived in a Mediterranean culture that was gradually drifting from an oral spoken culture to a written culture, a culture of written and recorded records. His great teacher, Socrates, never wrote anything down, like Jesus of Nazareth, another great teacher from 500 years later. Written words were not the way these teachers communicated. But Plato did write things down, and he was worried about this. And he, in his Phaedrus, writes about his fears, or he puts these words into the mouth of a character called Socrates, around the lifelessness of writing. It will encourage forgetfulness in its hearers. They will have a semblance of understanding but not know anything. They'll be like bad actors stumbling their way through a script. And yet he used the written word. He embraced the power and the risk of this lifeless language, this language that could travel apart from its speaker through time and space, that could preserve and create incredible informational complexities, but that perpetually risked being understood and couldn't speak for itself. And these concerns seem startlingly modern to me. He was a philosopher of information, and he realized that this cascading series of consequences come when you record and pool information, when you record such simple things as laws and property and loans, but also such complex things as what it meant to be alive 2,500 years ago, to love and to hope and to fear. And elsewhere in his writing, he writes again with great suspicion about the art of rhetoric, the art of persuasive speech. He compares a trial in front of a jury as a competition between a doctor and a cook to an audience of children, where the cook gets to present the children with tasty sweets and seduces them into doing whatever he wants, and the doctor tries to give them bitter medicine, the bitter medicine of truth, and is ignored. This sounds a lot like social media to me. The idea of rhetoric, the trouble that comes with the power of persuasion, and when that which is emotionally appealing can be divorced from its truth, its significance, its value. I'm not saying that Plato had all the answers, and I'm not saying there's no new thing under the sun, because, of course, the point Plato was making was that writing brings incredibly novel things, as computation does. But I think by looking at this very ancient series of debates, and we looked to the Middle Ages, we looked to the Church, which had this incredibly ambivalent relationship with printing post-Gutenberg. On the one hand, printing could get the word of God and the word of the Church out to the many. You could spread the truth. On the other hand, lots of other people with a different version of truth could get going a printing press and spread theirs. And suddenly it became very hard to control the truth. So these debates animate us. And by realizing their old debates, and by realizing that there is this incredible kind of richness and the sheer difference of what it meant to be human in different times and different places, I think we can realize that the simple stories we tell about AI does this are simply not true. One last example. AI is not one thing. AI is many technologies instantiated in many different countries under many different sets of values and regimes. What AI means in China is a very different thing to what it means in Europe, to America, to in Tehran or Moscow, or indeed Cape Town or Cairo. And so there are already many different possible futures out there, many different possible local visions of what technology should do and can do and might do. And so this vision of technology as this kind of conveyor belt that bears us forwards towards inevitable future is silly, is historically illiterate, is defeatist, is philosophically barren. is really a series of excuses to not think and not do the very difficult thing, which is to embrace the fact that we do have agency and control, but this is very unevenly distributed, it's very indirect, it's very difficult, but it's there and it's real.
Would you think, though, that everybody has the same ability to influence and control the development of technology?
Oh, no. No, no, absolutely. That's why I said it's unevenly distributed. Uh-huh. No, no. I mean, incredibly, you know, some people are hugely, hugely disempowered, maybe even the majority of people, utterly naive to sort of offer kind of lifestyle type advice saying, oh, you know, you should all put down your devices or you should protest against this. I mean, you know, if you're saying that to somewhere in Xinjiang province in China, you know, then very quickly, very unpleasant things are going to happen to them and their family. And if you're saying to a worker in a precarious position, oh, you know, you're being tyrannized by technology, you should stop doing what the various apps that you work precarious gig jobs through should do, you're just going to be cast aside. So power is incredibly unequally distributed. Opportunity and control are incredibly unequally distributed. So I am necessarily, when I say we, addressing it to a we where a few people have a lot of agency. But and it's a really big but, I think that nevertheless it's incredibly patronizing and dismissive and defeatist to say that someone in a difficult position has no agency, has zero agency. For, you know, it does an incredible disservice to the bravery of activists, of authors, of thinkers, of parents. There are many tiny acts. And to some degree, I think we need to do two things. We need to pay very close attention to what technology is actually doing to actual people in different places and different times, how it affects different lives, how it affects those who have less power and less privilege. And then we also need to look at the dynamics of the systems of regulation, of governance, of development, of oversight, of scrutiny, that if you are an engineer, that what you're building, if you are a citizen in a country where you're lucky to be free to vote and express your mind, of where you're allocating your attention, and what you're doing as a parent, as a citizen. So those opportunities for action we do variously have, I think we need to try and see where they fit into a bigger picture.
Mm.
But it's hard. I would not for a moment wish to sort of preach the panacea that some great amorphous we must rise up and do X or Y. You know, if we're lucky enough to have freedom, leisure, and some agency, you know, we want to pay to try to understand better the situations of others, to try to understand where we fit into these vast networks of networks that girdle the world.
And how does your thinking fit in now as we're seeing this AI summer in many ways happening, but which is being accompanied by an incredible consolidation of power? So only a few companies really can afford the computing power necessary to launch artificial intelligence as a sort of global technology. Most ordinary people and ordinary companies and even ordinary countries don't have access to data sets that you could describe as ethical, right? And most people can't have any say in how AI is being used on them, be it at work for surveillance or in school or facial recognition technology all over the United Kingdom or indeed many liberal democracies, to say nothing of authoritarian regimes. So everything that you've just discussed about power being distributed unevenly almost gets, like everything else to do with AI, amplified.
Yeah. It's hyper true.
How do you see that problem set, and how would your book help people who are looking to maybe, I don't know, take back control? It's a tricky phrase for all of us here in the UK, but empower themselves.
Yeah. And I think one way of taking back control, so to speak, is not simply accepting what you're told by vested interests at face value. I mean, it doesn't mean that everyone's lying to you, but it means they have a perspective. The story that AI can only be done by big companies in an opaque manner on dubiously ethical or non-transparent data sets. That's a story. That's a very convenient story. The story that tech can't be regulated is a story. The story that tech companies should regulate themselves is a story. The story that AI is this placeless everywhere thing. Now, the EU has just passed a massive piece of legislation which seeks to regulate AI at a root level in line with certain values. I mean, I'm sure the regulation is problematic in many ways, but equally, it is very much an effort to do what people said couldn't be done or shouldn't be done. In a very different sense, many years ago now, we remember the internet being preached as a kind of inevitable force of freedom. Inevitably, it was going to lead to the toppling of regimes in the Middle East, the liberalisation of countries in throughout the world and so on. And lo and behold, exactly as you say, dictatorial, oppressive regimes, or just those who had other ideas, said, no, thank you, this isn't inevitable, we're going to use this technology in this way, thank you very much. So again, that gives the lie to these silly narratives of the technology has this property. One of the fascinating things about AI, of course, is that it's only as good as the data it's trained upon. And even the big models have very severe problems with hallucination, with transparency, with predictability, with risk, with environmental impacts, and so on and so on. But also that in the open source world, if you look at the list of models maintained, documented by organizations like Hugging Face, you find that it's becoming cheaper and easier to run a model yourself, to train one up. I have a limited desktop computer and I can, in some skill, I can train up a model from scratch. It'll take me a while and I probably want to get some cloud processing, but it's perfectly possible for me to now train a model if I want to and fine tune it and so on. Small models may be a large part of the future. We don't know what this future is going to be. There's an enormous concentration of power in certain places, but as we've seen with things like facial surveillance, with profiling, with algorithms used in systems of justice, with algorithms that are potentially discriminatory when it comes to judgment, actually a great deal of pressure can be exerted through ethical and legal force, through courts in certain parts of the world, through asking questions and refusing simply to accept that the answer is it can't be done. I'm thinking of the face of, I think, the CTO of OpenAI when she was recently asked in an interview about the training data used for Sora, the video AI, and whether it included YouTube and open data or not. Artists and writers around the world have protested the use of their work without permission. And that has both moral and legal force. I should declare that I chair a couple of organizations devoted to the rights of creators and to helping them exercise those rights, the Authors Licensing Collecting Society and the Copyright Licensing Agency. And we see in these areas there being a very kind of clear case being made for questioning or unrolling or disputing or challenging some of the things that are being done. These actions are collective, of course, and, you know, legal cases are yet to be determined. I think collectively, under certain circumstances, very powerful challenges can be brought against various kinds of kind of hegemony and assumption. But yes, it is collective. And this is the thing that I try to say in the book. It's a difficult message, I think, that the freedoms we have and the choices we have are non-absolute. They're qualified, they're incremental, they're collective, they're imperfect. But this is the only kind of freedom that actually ever exists. And thus, it's the only kind of freedom that's ever really worth wanting. You're not really free till you understand the constraints surrounding you. You're not free in the context of technology until you realize the enormous numbers of ways in which it's constraining you and perhaps manipulating you. This is not a pessimistic message, I think. It's a message about the fact that once you have seen these things, then you have at least the possibility of entering with others into a negotiation with them. And until you see them, you are not free in very powerful, important senses because they are hidden from you.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Do you feel that there's anything new or different about how AI has provoked many discussions and narratives around existential dread, and also of machines outsmarting humans and I think probably turning us into their slaves or pets, depending on your point of view?
Oh, there's
how,
lots.
How is this different, or is it different?
Well, there's lots that's new here, because, I mean, there's lots that's new, my goodness. I mean, for, you know, machines beating humans at chess and Go and creating artworks indistinguishable from the works of humans and writing poetry. That's new. That's unbelievably new. And it brings news, right? It brings news about intelligence. I'd said it alongside some remarkable work into animal intelligence and tool making that's going on. You know, what you might call mind space, the idea that there are many different kinds of minds in the biological world, many different kinds of intelligence. My goodness, we're learning. We're learning that we are perhaps not what we thought we were, that we are informational organisms, that we, you know, I mean, computers are, AIs are brilliantly smart. I believe they're mindless, but they're mindlessly intelligent. So there's this huge, wonderful, vast challenge to our self-conception as a species. And then absolutely, when it comes to the products of these things, again, there's an enormous novelty here. You know, even in the, as it were, the business of AI, the power of what you might call transformer architectures, deep learning architectures, to generate from vast amounts of data incredibly kind of coherent, plausible, persuasive outputs. This is something truly remarkable, and it provokes truly remarkable debates. What is understanding? If they possess understanding conceptually, it doesn't look like ours. To some degree, I love Alison Gopnik, the psychologist and philosopher, her description of AI as a social technology, like a library, in the sense that it shows us the amount of knowledge and understanding that is latent in language and culture. As a writer, I'm acutely aware of the fact that when I write, language is speaking through me as much as I'm using it. I'm using a structure that was literally assembled by millions upon millions of humans, living and dead. You know, I am tapping into a vast form of collective intelligence when I string words together. And lo and behold, when we string together a few billion words and do advanced pattern recognition, they speak back to us with the kind of echoing voices of the countless dead. So it's a mysterious and wonderful time to be alive. And if you're not amazed by this, you're not paying attention. But the key thing is that in different forms, we've grappled with what it means to be human, with what the idea of rapture and transcendence and life and death are. I think the least interesting thing we can do with stories like the Singularity is take them literally. They're myths. They are rapture stories. They are theological ideas about the future. Maybe there's some truth in them, but even if there is some truth in them, which I think is unknowable, you know, what they're telling us is that we are deeply anxious in a profound way about the way that our power as a species is outstripping our self-control and self-knowledge. They speak to our desire not to die, which is a pretty old one. They speak to our desire to have perfect control, to escape death, to our fear of being judged and destroyed. And so, my goodness, we need all the tools in the box to talk about this stuff. Myth, psychoanalysis, technology, philosophy, ethics, art. We need to come together and talk about this. The idea that there's one way of talking about this and that it can be resolved to a consequentialist calculus of do these things or the bad AI is going to eat you and your children. Even if there's some truth in that, it's still an absurdly trite way of talking about it.
Well, that's interesting, because I guess my challenge to you as a questioner would be, do you think AI is just a tool and technology, or is it something that's redefining how we feel it means to be human?
Oh, it's redefining what it means to be human.
Because I don't ask that question about a pen or a calculator.
But you should, because a pen defined what it means to be human arguably more profoundly than AI has, right? Karl Popper said of Einstein, my pen and I are smarter than I am. To be human is to be a creature of language and technology. It is to be in the constant process of self-reinvention. So to be human is to be changed profoundly. We're born into a technological order. When we're young, when we're children, you think of a child is born into the world. They're not quite a blank slate, but you know, a child today is profoundly different to a child from 3,000 years ago, not because of biology or genetics, but because, like a sponge, the mind of that child, as it learns language and culture and technology, you know, becomes part of this kind of great connected entity that is the human technologized species. AI, technology, the internet vastly changed who we are. So did writing, so did literacy, so did religion, so did money, so did chairs, so did dwelling, so did fire. You know, the story of our species is the story uniquely of a technological culture surrounding a species that changes profoundly what it is to be a member of that species at any particular point in time. The idea that there are just tools and you use them well or badly, again, I think is kind of nonsensically oversimplified and doesn't really stand up to serious scrutiny. If I want to kill you, a gun is much better than a pen. If I want to launch a rocket to Mars using gravitational slingshots, a pen is only going to get me so far. If I want to have a conversation with the simulation of the ghost of Plato, again, a pen is only going to get me so far. Technologies change us and are part of us.
I guess this takes us on to this whole question of the future. And you've mentioned kids a lot in this conversation and also in your book in a really lovely way. And I'm intrigued by what you think it lies ahead and how to prepare them in terms of our educational system, the conversations that they're having, the fact that there's still a massive digital divide, even in many developed economies, to say nothing of, you know, the world and the way that some countries are really going to be ahead. Not just, you know, AI is the latest thing and it's the one we're talking about here, but we're preparing a whole generation of children to deal with climate change. We are preparing a generation of children to deal with something like we've just experienced with the pandemic, which could easily happen again. How are you thinking about what these next, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100 years are going to look like and the relationship for young people with technology so they can, you know, take advantage of it and protect themselves too?
So I spend a lot of time, I write textbooks for use in schools and universities about critical thinking and thinking skills and study skills. I've written a children's book for use in primary schools about neurodiversity. I spend quite a lot of time doing talks and workshops with children. I am absolutely fascinated by these questions. One way I sometimes put it is that, you know, in the world today, we have marvelous technologies that are endlessly capable of giving us answers. They can plausibly and endlessly answer any question. But only we can come up with questions and decide which questions are worth asking in the first place. The purposes and values begin and end with us. When it comes to future skills, you know, that very loose bundle of skills I sometimes call critical thinking, I think are incredibly important. because it's partly about ownership of your own thoughts and knowing what to do with these tools at your disposal. You know, given that you have a tool with endless potential, your ability to use it well and thoughtfully, your ability to see through attempts at manipulation and deception, your ability to think about the systems you're enmeshed in and their connectedness. So this connects to ideas of systems thinking, of environmental and ecological thinking. What are, you know, because it's these often hidden systems that are determining how you're being judged, how you're being surveilled, the services you're getting, what the information you see or don't see. Your ability to have a negotiation with these in some kind of state of comprehension or power is a crucial part of modern citizenship. Your almost intuitions for these. I encourage kids to play with AIs, to experiment with them, and not to anthropomorphize them, not to consider them as rivals, to consider them potentially as partners, as extensions of their own minds. And the question is then, what does it mean to use them well? To use them to deepen your thinking, to elevate your thinking. And what does it mean as a society to avoid the denigration of human agency and thought? This, of course, is for governments, for companies. What does it mean to legislate for humans, human thriving? Humans want purposeful work. Humans need a certain degree of bodily security. Humans, in my view, need a degree of privacy, of freedom from certain kinds of measuring and tracking and surveillance. Now, globally, I can't make my hands and wave this kind, make this kind of thing go away, but you can try and very clearly advocate for it and come up with practical legislation focused upon harms and freedoms. Ultimately, of course, I don't have all the answers. I think you're quite right to say, you know, when one looks at development, economics and so on, you want to enable people to be thinkers, to participate in society, to have rich lives. All of the first things you do have nothing to do with technology and everything to do with peace, with security from bodily fear, with having enough food to eat, with having, you know, a basic kind of de minimum of equality and security. Without these things, flourishing is almost impossible. And so you come to the very basic point that in order to enable all this wonderful, great, marvelous technological stuff, you start with the non-technological, with the human body, with the human animal. The link I forge here, leaning on work like that of the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre in his later works like Dependent Rational Animals, is that we are animals. Not to denigrate us, but we are brains in bodies. And the most fundamental things that give us purpose are to do with our relations with others, the love we receive and give, the care we receive and give. We're born into utter dependency upon other humans. We're born as these tiny, amazing, vulnerable little things who take years and years and years to gradually be inculcated into the vast riches of human culture and society. We die in dependence upon others. Everything we have, everything we read, eat, do, live in, is the product of this vast web, this global web of ingenuity and manufacture and maintenance. The idea of the kind of solitary life is just, again, utterly incoherent in the context of our species. It's very, very expensive indeed to live a solitary and independent life. You're using vast amounts of money to pay vast amounts of other people to support you. You know, these silly bunkers that billionaires have under the ground on Earth, they think they're doing. And so this dependency is where I locate hope, in our absolute embrace of our biological, emotional, social and technological codependency, and our doubling down upon seeking to understand the drives and needs that make for a worthwhile life, and then legislate and build the skills and conditions that make sure that we are asking of technology questions worth answering.
I did think that was actually the freshest and most innovative chapter in your whole book, which is the third one on love and learning, where you say, and I underlined it here with an exclamation point of like, my God, this is new. One of the most important answers to the questions you were asking has little to do with ingenuity and everything to do with a word less commonly used in the context of technology, love. And I thought, wait, where is he going with this? And you bring out this great perspective. This is something I would urge anybody who is looking for a new way of thinking, that love, nurture, and learning are human beings' supreme survival strategies. And that is something that I have never thought about in all of my work and all of my thinking in technology, of what does that mean? And of course, that question of, you know, what does it mean to be human? Does AI make us think about being human differently? They can't love. We can't program them to love. Even if we gave them programmed responses to sound like they're being empathetic or sound like they're loving, the fact is they just aren't. Because we ourselves don't even always understand why we love or don't love. In theory, you should love your parents or your kids, but we also know that's not always true. God knows why we decide to be friends with someone or not. And some friendships are deeply powerful. And we can completely fall in love with someone. And then when we're asked why do you love me? The person's like, I can't tell you. It's you're you, right? So how on earth does this quality that makes us so human sit alongside productively, usefully, with this other quality that we have, which is we are inherently technological beings. We're constantly inventing tools and technologies, and we want to use them well.
Two sides of the same coin, where it begins and ends with love. And that's not a kind of little bumper sticker. That's a rigorous anthropological observation. There is no future without children. But raising children is a task of incredible self-sacrifice. It requires enormous dedication on the part of parents. Again and again in social science surveys, you see that having kids, broadly speaking for most people, makes them less happy in a day-to-day hedonic sense. You're knackered and tired and overextended, you're not going out anymore, you know. Or in certain circumstances, you're desperately trying to feed these little things you desperately, desperately love and care about more than your own life. But it gives people purpose. It's also, for many people, not all people, the biggest thing in their lives. But love is broader than that. The Greeks knew this. They had many types of love. Eros, agape, different definitions to love. Why do we pursue computer science? Why do we pursue knowledge? Why do we want to explore the universe? Why do anything? Why not just sit still and inject yourself with heroin? And the answer is partly love, the love of learning, the love that is inspired by beauty, the love of the mysteries of the universe, even the love of power. You know, it's you need to go back to these drives. The future of our species is, in the most boringly literal sense, guaranteed or not by our ability to raise generation after generation. And this demands love. It is love. It demands this compassionate, mutually caring drive. Unfortunately, of course, many of the atrocities we commit are also born from, if you like, the perversion of these passions. The tribal allegiances that lead us to other and hate. But remarkably, the anthropologist and primatologist Sarah Bluffer Hurdy makes this point. We get on with other humans instinctually and innately better than any other species. It's so much more fundamental than the whole, stick other people with spears and beat them. Technology is collaboration far more than competition. This is just such an obvious point that's lost. You know, it is a compendium of achievements and sharing. Yes, it can look like an arms race, but underneath the arms race is this vast fundamental structure of shared and inherited and taught and relearned and challenged knowledge. Scientific knowledge is one great vast party of collaboration and cooperation and sharing and hope. It's love, it's faith in the future. And when you get down to it, actually, egotism is a terrible explanation for human beings and why we do anything. It's a dumb explanation. The philosopher Samuel Scheffler has a great thought experiment. And he says simply, imagine that the minute after you die, however you live a long, long life, and that the minute after you die, the world is annihilated by an asteroid and everything is gone. How does that change how you feel if you know with certainty that this will happen? And most people say, well, I'd find that pretty depressing. It hollows out the value of most of the things I believe in. It makes my life feel futile. You know, but why? You can't experience it. By definition, leaving aside any questions of an afterlife, by definition, this will have no effect upon you or your pleasures whatsoever. But of course, the value of almost everything we love and believe in and enjoy is bound up with some belief or sense in its continuity and it existing after us and it being a vaster identification. It's part of something larger than ourselves. You know, and as you say, machines don't have these things. It's not like a black mark against machines. They just don't. We give them their purposes and they pursue them mindlessly and relentlessly. But we have purposes. We have passions. We have loves. These can be perverted. These can be strange. But it's the most fundamental fact there is. It's undoubtedly the evolved fact that somehow allowed us to raise these incredibly vulnerable children and teach them and pass on our culture and iterate it and build and reach for the stars. It's love. That's what it's all about.
I love it. On that wonderful note, sounding very much like the Beatles, love is all we need.
It's not all we need. We need loads of other stuff as well.
Well, as I say, it's the driving force, though, that animates so much that's worthwhile in this life. It's just left for me to say thank you. That was Tom Chatfield, who's author of Wise Animals, How Technology Has Made Us What We Are. It's available now from Penn Macmillan and at a bookstore near you. I'm Stephanie Hare. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Mia Sorrenti and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.